This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher.
Through their diverse range of publications, New Society Publishers books explore topics that are at the forefront of creating positive change in our world. From regenerative agriculture and permaculture to social justice and eco-conscious living, their books cover a wide spectrum of subjects that empower readers to lead more regenerative and fulfilling lives. Now, whether you're a seasoned environmentalist, a curious beginner, or someone simply seeking inspiration and guidance on your journey towards regenerative living, New Society Publishers is here to support you every step of the way. Now exclusively for listeners of this podcast, you can use the code SKILLS25 and receive a 25% discount on all ebooks at newsociety.com. That's all one word and lowercase, SKILLS25 on all ebooks. So level up your knowledge today at newsociety.com.
All right, before we get started today, I have to be honest with you. You can probably hear a tick, 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 tick in the background of my voice, and that's the oven timer. You're probably wondering why I am recording the intro to this in my kitchen. Well, that's a legitimate question. Turns out my partner Alba and I were out all the way up until it got dark fixing up the mobile chicken coop because we've got little baby hens that are ready to go outside pretty soon. And it's my turn to make dinner and I'm late. And I'm recording this the Thursday night before the episode comes out. That's just how my life goes sometimes. Sorry, I hope you can get through the ticking noise. So let's get down to it. I've had the pleasure over the last few months to interview quite a few people that I admire who've told me about their fascination with beekeeping. Over and over again, I've heard about the incredible insights into overall ecological health and the amazing reflections of ecosystem function that can be observed through managing beehives. Now, I got a window into the world of natural beekeeping back in May of last year when I co-hosted a Climate Farmers community event at Wilmersgarten, a regenerative farm just south of Berlin. Since then, I've been looking for an opportunity to speak with Uli Beckmann, the instructor on the course on beekeeping and management, who helped me to see a whole new possibility on how to promote healthy colonies that in turn promote healthy ecosystems and people. And so that's exactly what today's episode is all about. Uli's company, Beckmann Yourtract, was founded in 2015 with the aim of consistently working in such a way that the beekeeper takes a backseat to the needs of the bees. Today, their principles and their way of working far exceed anything required to be certified as an organic beekeeper. Natural propagation, natural honeycomb built entirely by the bees, natural nutrition and minimal intervention are their maxims. Because every jar of honey that we hold in our hands, we must not forget that the bees did not produce this for us, but as food for themselves. Beckmann Yourtract is the alternative to maximizing yields and obtaining varietal honeys. The end result is an honest, original honey that can be harvested only in small quantities, but is outstanding in terms of quality and taste, as well as its ecological and bee-friendly production. In today's conversation with Uli, we start by comparing and contrasting the conventional practices of industrial beekeeping and how they differ from the principles that guide natural beekeeping. From there, we go into the details of not only the life cycle and the behavioral patterns of bees and how these inform how to manage them well, but also the practical side of building hives that promote their health and the environmental factors that present a real challenge to the future of the species. In the process, we also unpack the history of beekeeping in Europe and the innovators that have pioneered new management methods based on relationship over extraction. We cover advice on how to get started with your own hive and expectations of time and equipment for beekeeping as well. And I'm sure by the end of this episode, you'll come to understand why many of the most influential and insightful people in the world of regenerative land management have become beekeepers themselves. And so here, to open a window into the world of bees, is Uli Beckmann. So welcome, Uli. It's great to speak to you again. It's been over half a year now since we met in person, and I had the pleasure of taking a small workshop with you at Wilmersgarten in just south of Berlin. And well, how are you doing? Where are you at the moment? I know you've been traveling quite a bit.
Yeah, I've been traveling. I've been to Australia, which I usually am in the European winters because bees are hibernating. So I have been back to New South Wales for a couple of months now. Just arrived back to Berlin a bit before bee work picks up here again because bees are still hibernating at this place. So yeah, right now getting ready for the new season.
Marvelous. And can you give our listeners an idea of your background and how you started to work with bees and apiculture?
Yes. Yes, of course. Now, my background is quite colorful, I'd say. So I started in teaching, then I went into theater, then I went into a bit of a movie making, then I went into beekeeping. And ever since I stuck with beekeeping, I really just dug my own way through what is beekeeping, how is it usually done, towards the direction where I thought in the beginning that that actually should be beekeeping. So it's been a lot of learning by doing, and now I'm where I'm at, and it's a great spot to be. It's quite lonely. I would invite people to join, but it's great to be where I am now.
Well, hopefully listeners will be inspired to join, and I would imagine you're going to get a lot of interest after the incredible perspective on beekeeping that I've learned from you and that we hope to share today. So maybe to get us started off, give me a sense of what the industrial or the majority of beekeeping looks like today, as for reference of how later what we'll be describing is different.
Yes. So the thing is that where we are with the beekeeping right now, pretty much globally, unless you have really, really hobby beekeepers in not very modern, let's say, countries, you are pretty much with what I would call the race car system of beekeeping. So at some point, beekeepers decided that it's all about honey. And they adapted the beehive design towards a race car making a lot of honey. And that has taken over completely. So this is the understanding that people now would have when talking about beekeeping. And that is quite far away from what bees would do if they live a free life in nature. So the approach that we're dealing with when we talk about beekeeping is people having a hive set up into a brood nest, which would be, say, the lower box of it. Then there would be a divider, a so-called queen excluder, which makes sure that the queen, the egg-laying bee, does not walk through it. On top of our brood nest, we would have a second box, and that second box would be the honey stores. So all the bees can do, since the queen can't go up through the queen excluder into the honey store, is store honey. That's all that space is there for. This box we can take off. We know our queen is in the lower box, so we don't have to worry about our actual hive down there. And we check on an empty box. This is being filled. We take it off again. We spin out the honey, empty the frames, put the frames back on. And we do this several times a year. So there's actually taking honey off the top of an existing bee colony. So we do have a colony divider, really, which goes breeding in the lower bottom, behave like that's natural. Honey in the top bottom, have it for me to take off. End of season, feed sugar, so bees have something to live on over winter. And next spring, go again. So that's what we're looking at. At the same time, we're looking at the fact that pretty much all over the world now, including Australia, where I've just been, we have a mite called varroa mite. And that is the main danger to bee colonies right now. Added to all the other dangers which we have is not enough food, not enough places to live, no free mating. So the genetical deprival and all that kinds of stuff. Now varroa mite comes on top of that. It has been here for quite a long while. In countries in Asia, bees found a way to adapt naturally. We treat. So the West likes to do the industrial honey production, so we don't want any loss in that. So we treat against this varroa mite. So on top of honey off, sugar on, we do treat against the mite, so bees don't have a real chance to adapt. And that means we keep production colonies alive. That's what we do when we're talking about beekeeping. We have honey producers, and we keep them alive even though there is a danger to them by treating against their main threat. So they can produce the honey, which we take and put on again and take off again and then feed sugar and get them through into the next year. So that's what it's all about. Next to that, it's about pollination. So farming needs pollination. And therefore, bees are very often migrated through countries from one pollination spot to another pollination spot. Very, very famous almond pollination in the United States, but also in pretty much every other country, including small countries like Germany, we have people traveling their beehives to the rapeseed fields, then traveling them through the next whatever, cornflower or whatever you need in farming. So just to get the honey in, because our surroundings have changed so much that there's actually not a lot of blossoming anymore, especially in the east of Germany. It's just razor flat fields of whatever you want to put on for miles and miles. And that's just pollination desert for the bees, food desert for the bees. But if there's something on, then it needs a lot of bees. So we get the migration. Migration also means a lot of colonies meeting from all kinds of beekeeping, a lot of disease crossing over to other colonies. So we get all these denaturalized bee colonies doing stuff which is led by the beekeeper to focus on honey or money-making pollination. So that's what it is. That's beekeeping. That's where we get all our honey from. And that's what the reality is the bees are living in right now.
That was a fantastic overview of where we are at currently. And there's so many things within what you described that we can dive deeper into. And I think we could start perhaps with the history of beekeeping in Europe, because this is what we perhaps have most reference to at the moment, and how mm-hmm. that has been transformed into the industrial scale of honey production that you described. How did that transition happen?
That's really, really, really cool, because when you look at beekeeping, how it actually started for human mankind, you get these cave paintings of someone crawling up a tree, sticking his hand into a tree hole, grabbing a bit of honeycomb out of it and having it. So I always imagine, who was that guy back then, some 10,000 years ago or whenever? Was he right, either the bravest or just the stupidest guy in the company who had
some
to
combination jump. Of the two?
Probably. So that's how we would have harvested honey. So we would find a wild bee colony living in a hollow in our area, northern Germany here. That would have been a tree hollow. Could be any hollow. Could be a little cavity somewhere in a rock or whatever it will be. And just take out a comb, and on that comb there would be bee brood, and there would be honey. And that would be a fantastic meal, because with a bee brood, you would have a lot of protein to eat. And with the honey, you would have a lot of sugar to eat. So that is actually really, really good food for you to keep you going. The idea, of course, is to climb up that tree, take a comb. Because if you take the colony, that colony is dead. So there's no more harvesting for the next guy. And so that's how it all started. People tracking bee colonies, knowing where they live, in what hollow they live, understanding how they progress, how they move on into the next hollow, making up a map of, okay, this is harvestable ground. There are the mushrooms that I'm picking. That's the berries I'm picking. There is the honey I'm picking. And that's how you would have set it up. Now, at some point, people decided that climbing up a tree is quite an effort to do, and waiting for a colony to move into a tree hollow as well. You can only stick the hand through a little hole. Why don't we prep that hole a little bit to our needs? So it would begin with something that we call Seidlering in Germany, which is putting a hole into a tree. So you climb up the tree, you have your little axe, you chuck your hole in it, you close the hole again, but for a little like bee entrance, the colony moves in or you move it in. That's already beekeeping. So you have a swarm, you put the swarm into that little cavity, hoping it stays. Or you take brood comb out of one tree, put it into the next tree, and hope that it'll requeen. So then you put your colony into a hollow that you've designed. And then you work that hollow by taking off the board that you put to close it, take off the honey, put the board back on. Easier. Next step would be, why do I actually climb up a tree? Why don't I cut that chunk of tree and set it on the ground, so I don't have to climb it up? So now we have a log hive. Log hive is a tree trunk with a hollow that I put in and a board in front of the hollow with the entrance for the bee, but the bee still does everything on its own. The colony builds its own comb. The colony requeens and mates freely. The colony only feeds on honey and pollen, which it collects. So it's a free living colony in a tree which by some natural disaster got cut by a beekeeper and put on the ground. But that really doesn't bother me too much as a bee colony. It's maybe a bit too low. Maybe the temperatures coming in are not really perfect. Maybe there's way more humidity coming into my hive all of a sudden. So I will have to do something about this as a bee colony. But I can. It's still quite a thick-walled hollow. I can keep temperature here, but that would already be a step towards we're interfering. But bee colonies can totally adapt to it. So that's okay. Next step is really this putting holes into a trunk and just cutting it down. And that's a lot of effort. So what is it about? It's about shelter, right? So why don't we build shelter? Make it a lot easier. Just, I don't know, build a box. Let's build a box. So we put the box, put the bees in. Now our box is not that thick of wood. It's only maybe that thick of wood. So we have, right now it's usually 2.2 centimeters, which we would have as a width of our boards. And let's hammer that together and put the bees in there, but they still can build their own comb. Next step is that some guy, Langstroth his name, looked at bee colonies and said, well, if I look at the frames that they build, of the combs they build, I see that there is a certain space between every comb. And that space between comb and comb, which the bees build, always seems to be the same. And he figured out that it's about 6 to 9 millimeters. So everything of size between one comb and the next, more than 6 to 9 millimeters, would be added with more comb. But that's what he called the bee space. So looking at a colony, he found one comb, second comb, space in between, and just enough space for two bees to go in, one bee to take care of that comb, and the next bee to take care of that comb, being back on back. So that's perfect space use. Just as many bees can I get into one small ball, which is then warming all the brood. Now he said, perfect, I see this space, so why don't I build little wooden frames in which the bees can still build their natural comb, and I can then take out those frames, and I can see them from both sides, I can work them if I have to, I can also take them out for honey. So I don't have to cut stuff and stripping all over the place. So now we are box frames. Next.
These are these flat sheets and slats that
not
most
yet
of us are most familiar with when we think about kind of the honey.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Honey so extraction process, exactly. Right? You're taking out these sheets that have been printed the comb on them, yeah.
Yeah, so these sheets then were the next step. So then he said, well, the bees are building all this comb, really. Why don't I help them and not have them build comb anymore? So I give them comb. So I just give them a wax sheet, really, into my frame. And then all they have to do is draw it out three-dimensionally to put the larvae in, to the eggs, and then to grow the larvae in, to put the honey in,
So the pattern is pre-printed on them.
The pattern is pre-printed. So this is how far then the beekeepers thought it would be helping. Now, giving them wax sheet as a help already is one step too much. That the latest would be the point where we have to draw back, because wax comb, which the bees build out of their own bodies, bees sweat wax. And from day 19 on, they really want to do that of their lives. So they want to sweat wax. They want to build comb. And it's a very hygienic part to build new comb for a colony. Bees tear down old comb. So when I'm in Australia, I really work with very, very old colonies that have been brought there in the very beginning of bees getting into Australia. So they are wild bees. And they behave completely different to our bees that we have in Europe right now, because they are still acting wild, and it is wild working with them too. So you really have to be ready for a fight with those bees. But they tear down old comb and then they build new comb. So building new comb is very important for a healthy colony. Giving them a wax, like a wax sheet, which is made of old comb, of course, because you have to somewhere harvest wax, melt it down, put it in that sheet, give it to the bees. It's quite a thick thing. It's about a millimeter thick, this wax sheet. Now, bees' comb, which they built, is 0.07 millimeters thick. So that is way, way less. Yeah. Yes, quite a difference. Important, because bees communicate on their comb. So a bee would sit on it, would grab onto it, would shake it, would rattle the comb. That vibration would go in the darkness of a bee colony across the comb, calling bees and knowing, okay, that's where the shaking happened. I have to go to that bee because this bee will be telling me important information about where to find forage, about how quality of the forage is, all these things. Now, sitting on a wax sheet, which is this thick, all that rattling is not going to do a lot. So the communication is just going a lot less. Less
communication. Just dampened their ability to communicate.
Yeah, exactly. So that's giving this wax sheet would be the next step where we say we have to take it off. And then we would add our little queen excluder, and then we would come into the spot of putting a lot of wax sheets above my brood nest. My brood nest needs to be warm. Putting an empty box on top of it means all the warmth goes up into this honey box, which the beekeeper now decides he wants to have the honey box, because by observing what do bees naturally is, yes, they store the honey above their heads. But that takes months, and in our cases, with the way I do it now, years, for them to slowly store hatching bee honey in, next hatching bee honey in, and the honey just pushes down the brood nest over years. So there is no heat loss, because you always have a thermal mass on top. It's either brood or it turns into honey. Now, with this box thing, you always put on empty space on the brood nest. So there is always heat loss, always heat going up. The brood needs to be taken care of. So bees start heating like crazy down here. They really work their lives off, because they work way, way more now, creating way more heat, because it's all going up into the attic. And that attic is empty. So it's, okay, guys, we have to get that attic filled because we need thermal mass. Put the honey in quick. So they all check the honey in like crazy to get the thermal mass. Once you have it, it's been taken off. And again, you have your next wax sheet empty on top. So that's
remarkable.
It develops towards this, what I call the race car system.
Yeah. So by messing with the architecture of the hive, you also drastically change the behavior by which the bees communicate, self-regulate the heat within their space, and also how quickly they're pushed to create food. Which, yes, of course, is the incentive, right? This is where you get the surplus of honey that you're constantly taking off. You have something to sell. It's not by accident, but it has, I can only imagine, a hugely detrimental effect on the health of the hive itself.
That's the interesting thing. When you talk to beekeepers, they say, look, all the bees do is chuck in honey anyway. So if I do this box thing, just putting an empty box on top, there is nectar out there. That's what bees do. They put it on top. They put it in the box anyway. So why would I stop them from doing that? If there is honey there, they won't do that much. And I think, yeah, but that's the point, isn't it? So if they don't have to take care of all the honey making, what else can they do? And we know bees just don't hang around. So they will then take care of the brood, meaning the brood will be a lot healthier bee. And that means that, especially with the breeding, temperature being adjusted by bees on the brood is not just happening as we need to sit on eggs and they all need to be nice and warm, but bees actually apply temperature differently to their brood. So there is a certain percentage of brood which is heated a lot. Another percentage of brood is heated a lot less. And that's by decision of the bee, because the more heated the brood is, the more sensitive it is to everything. So that would be a bee going, well, it's colder in here, I need to start heating earlier than the not so warm bred bee would do. There is a threat coming, so I'm attacking earlier than the not so well bred bee would do. I need to clean stuff earlier than the not so very well bred bee would do. So you have a range of behavior, which is quite good, because if it gets warmer and every bee starts cooling, then you have these jumps. If there is a danger and every bee starts defending, then you have war. You don't want. You want a gradual system adapting to the situation slowly. So by taking away the possibilities for the bees to breed in different temperature zones, which they decide, we take away the graduality of their way of reacting to whatever happens outside. So that is a huge influence.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it was a long time ago that I did another episode on specifically top bar beekeeping, a different configuration of a hive. And the woman told me that the imprinted sheets of wax that are put into these traditional hives actually dictate somewhat what type of bee is incubated in them. that by having them all one single size, they're pushed to make only worker bees and perhaps not the right configuration or balance of, let's say, drones or others that are needed for a healthy community. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Yes, drone cells are bigger than worker bee cells. So if you give them an imprinted sheet with only the size of the worker bees, which is what you give them because you want worker bees, because you want them to work, because only drones don't do any honey. The drones are really very important for temperature within the whole hive. But they eat a lot of honey. They fly a lot. They are meant for mating. But since you buy your queen and you go, well, look, I'm just going to buy a super egg-laying, wonderful honey-making, superb queen in the color that I prefer, you don't need the drones. So you give them these imprinted sheets. It's only worker bees coming in, and you're actually castrating your hive. It's just you're not having a male power in your hive, and therefore you can't go for free mating, and therefore your colonies can't just go with the natural selection. And the best natural hives survive, and therefore they can adapt to the natural challenges that they're facing, which they have been doing for 30 million years. So we must not forget that bee colonies can do very well without beekeepers, because when they started existing, there was not an idea of us being around.
Yeah, that's very important. Now, I'd like to start to move over to talking about alternatives to this system and the work that you do. But before we do that, I think it's important to take a step back and specify what we're talking about when we're talking about beekeeping, because there are hundreds of types of bees, and we are talking about bees right now as if they were one species. Can you clarify that for me?
Yes. So what we're talking about when we're talking about beekeeping, of course, is working with the honeybee. Now, there are different types of honeybees all over the world. I will be talking about beekeeping, let's say, in more or less Western cultures. So that would be Europe, that would be United States, that would be the places that we, Australia as well, that we Western people took our honeybee to produce honey. In other cultures, bees would still be honeybees. They would be different types of honeybees. Some of these, as I said, already adapted to challenges that we in the West still have. But it's honey beekeeping. It's not solitary beekeeping. So we do have a lot more bees than the honeybees, but these bees would usually, not always, be solitary bees, meaning they live a year, they hatch, they lay their eggs. These eggs go and hatch into other bees. They winter in the ground. They lay their eggs. They die. So that's just their little range is of life. It's about a yearly life. They have usually a range of maybe 500 meters in which they live. They need very, very good spaces of food, of hiding away. So they have a small range of life, and they are super important within the small range because they can do pollination, which honeybees can't do because they're built differently. They might have longer trunks to just get into the plants, and they together with honeybees, they assure perfect pollination. Not only honeybees or only feral bees like solitary bees can do all the pollination, because honeybees in exchange would travel further. They go really far. They easily go 5 kilometers. They can go 10 kilometers away from their hive. So they cover huge grounds compared to these 500 meters that a solitary bee would do. But there's way more solitary bee types than there's honeybee types. So we're talking honeybee when we talk beekeeping, because no one keeps bees, solitary bees. We have these little hotels that you all know with the little holes and where bees can crawl in. That's not beekeeping. That's just just allowing space for bees to breed.
It's just habitat.
It is intentional. It is about harvesting food, which is nothing bad, as long as you do it along with the bee colony.
Yeah. So, okay. So now let's talk about what collaborative beekeeping can look like rather than, it's kind of funny to use the word colonize when we're talking about bees, but this forced bee production model that we're now looking at alternatives to. So give me an idea about how you approach this in contrast.
Yeah. So what I did in the very beginning when I learned the beekeeping is that I noticed this is not how bees could have lived before we started beekeeping, because there's way too much effort, there's way too much going on, there's way too much us doing stuff to the colony. So how actually do they live if we don't exist? Because beekeepers told me when I started, bees can't live without beekeepers anymore. They need us to survive. And I thought, this is impossible. Well, that's if that's the case, then we're really in deep trouble, because we won't be here forever. And that means that bees then won't be here either. And that means that we lose about 80% of whatever's out there because of pollination. So I looked at natural bee behavior. And so what do they do in the wild? What do bees colonies do when they're not being, when they don't meet, when they don't have any beekeeper keeping them? So what they would do is, there would be a swarm once a year. Swarm would be the old queen, the queen from last year, taking about 70% of the bees inside a hive with her and migrating towards a hollow, which they would move into and build new comb and live there. Whilst in the colony that was left by the queen, a new queen would grow up, would get mated by the drones that are in the area, and then build a new colony there. So from one bee colony, we get two bee colonies. Old queen moves over here, new queen raises here. But these two colonies would now, that would be the actual progression of the bee. So that would be one, two out of one. They build their comb, they have their little hollow, they start building the comb. Queen lays eggs in the top, because they built the comb from the ceiling down towards the ground of the hollow. Once they've built a little bit, the queen would put her eggs in here. Those eggs would then become into larvae. They would hatch after 3 weeks. That would give a little space. With every bee hatching, a cell would be freeing. That's where the honey would be put in. Then we would have a lot of honey all over the sudden because all the bee hatched. So we build a new comb. The queen now lays her eggs here. This is our small little honey dome that we've got so far. Bees in here, hatching cell by cell, more honey in. Now the honey dome is a little bit bigger. Still no place for the queen to lay eggs again. So more comb. So that's, we build a long comb surface, usually 8 to 6 combs next to each other, because bees prefer a certain type of hollow, like 40 to 60 leeches. That's what they really love. That's what they would go for. And so this way we would have, after a year and a winter, because in winter the colony would move back up into the honey, which is why they put it on top, which makes it so beautifully easy for beekeepers to take the top box. It's warm up there. So whatever I do down here as a beehive, it'll warm my honey. So in winter, I can go into this warm honey dome that I have, which is a great place to winter. I mean, even for me, it's a beautiful idea to live within a warm honey dome in winter. That's perfect. So that's where they go. That's where they feed into. And then in spring, they would again go downwards, because again, queen lays eggs, eggs hatch, more honey in. So we say the honey dome presses the brood downwards.
Now, if we real quickly, because you've been using all sorts of gestures that are very helpful for me to visualize this, for the people who are listening, we're looking at sort of a cylinder within the hollowed out trunk of a tree, in which comb and honey formation is concentrated on the top, and there's this internal migration, which you've been indicating to me, as they move down towards the base, and the honey fills that space up above, which helps to maintain a thermal mass and temperature conditions, which are conducive for them for self-regulation and health. As they then get into winter, they move up, consuming the honey that is their reserve, their storage for when there is not nectar and pollination happening in the environment around them. And then once again in spring, as they've consumed a lot of that, they begin to move down again. And so there are these kind of waves or pulses within the cylinder of the hollow tree that makes for a healthy cycle of life through the different seasons. Is that correct?
Yes, it says. So we have a constant up and down movement through the year, from down to up in the winter to down again when it comes to spring. That's how it moves. Also, our honey stores above, they would grow. And then over winter, they would, of course, be eaten, but not everything, because there's more than bees need. And then again, it would grow. So all this mass of honey would be spread around the hive. At some point, it would also be spread to the side walls. So the honey would actually really be a dome surrounding our bee colony. It can even happen that if there is a lot of honey coming in, they put honey underneath the brood nest. So they would be really covered, completely surrounded by honey.
Wow.
Yes, this movement happens. And I think it is quite important that the colony can do this movement because it always goes with the temperature. So bees will make sure that what they need most to make sure that the brood is growing well and healthy, they go with this temperature. So yeah, that's exactly the movement we will be having. And if we look at that, and if we look at this over a couple of years, we find that actually this setup is being just built perfectly by the bee from some point where they say, look, there is always honey on top. There's always honey on the sides. And there's always space for us to move downwards and to give the queen free space to lay eggs. At some point in the year, and now this is exactly the spot where beekeeping becomes super interesting to me, because now watching a colony, knowing what it does over the years and not over 1 year, it's really important to think several years. In my case, it's 3 years. It depends on how much honey and how much nectar actually can come into the hive. I see, okay, this honey there on top is luxury honey for the bees. The honey underneath the luxury honey now after 3 years is what they need. They need this to winter in. Sometime in the year when a lot of nectar comes in, since there is so much honey already on top of my hive, they have to put the honey into any cell available for them. So that means a lot of honey on top, no space to put any nectar there. Every cell that now hatches, and that's in our area is towards the beginning, middle of May. Any cell that now hatches is being filled with nectar because the stuff has to go somewhere. So the queen runs out of space to lay eggs because it's really the nest is flooding with nectar. These bees become what we call, beekeeper would call it honeybound. So the beekeeper would say, I have to do something about this now because my bees can't put the honey anymore. They can't lay eggs anymore. My colony is actually getting smaller and smaller because they're running out of space. I have to do something about it. I have to take the honey off. I have to give them extra space. What did bees do before beekeepers had the idea to help them? They must have solved this problem somehow without us. So what they do is they swarm. There's no more space for more bees. So this is the moment where they go, yeah, perfect timing, lots of honey coming in. There's not actually a chance for the queen to lay eggs here. We just swarm, we multiply. We make 2 out of 1, which is perfect because that means we live on in an empty spot. We build new comb, we put in new honey. There's so much coming in right now. We will even have enough time to chuck enough stuff up there so that we can winter the first year. Dangerous, might not work out because the weather might be bad, but hey, that's life and we're leaving our genetics into the already set up hive that we come out of anyway. This then new queen will mate with the drones and she will be genetically adapted by one little notch, one more year of actual genetics out there. So that's what bees do when there's too much nectar coming in. Looking at that as a beekeeper, I say, okay, so if I want to make sure that I get my honey, and if I want to make sure that the bees can also thrive by swarming, why don't I just wait for the swarm to happen? And yes, now have only 30% worker bees because 70% just flew off. Yes, my hive is not productive at all in this moment, so I can't make a lot of honey, but that's exactly why they swarmed, because there's too much honey. So now, if there is too much honey, I can take it. That's the perfect moment for a beekeeper to come in and say, okay, you're having too much. You've just swarmed, so you've done what you need to do. You're only 30% bees. Of course, you're left with all the brood that your old queen before she left put into your cell. So all this brood will be hatching within 3 weeks. So 3 weeks from now, you will be again a strong hive. New queen. lots of eggs. She's new queens lay up like crazy. They just make extremely compact brood nests, which means all these bees will be very healthy because they're very close to each other. Now I can take the honey. Now I will have a strong colony that will bring in enough nectar for their winter once I took it off. That's okay. So this is looking at a bee colony and going with it. At the same time, it's varroa mite again. So we're having this mite which grows potentially with the colony's growth. So the more bees, the more mite. A colony swarming also means no eggs for the queen, from the queen, for 4 weeks. So no place for the mites to go for 4 weeks. So the mite curve drops down. And now going into winter, we have less mite pressure on the colony. We've harvested at a moment where honey was actually too much. And from that point on, we leave our colonies and set it up for the winter. So actually that means very, very little intervention. Going into the beehive, maybe 3 times a season at my spot, because we only have 3 to 5 months of actual beekeeping. And instead of that, leaving the colony alone and doing what it would naturally do.
And there's, okay, first of all, that's fascinating. And it just brought up so many more questions for me. Maybe we can go back and look at how you construct your hives in order to facilitate this type of natural behavior and health of a hive that the other configurations we've talked about don't do.
Yeah, so the first thing we don't use is the queen excluder. So we still have, in my case, I still use boxes. I can put as many boxes on top of each other as I need to create a hollow, which is similar to what they would like to find in a tree. Now, I'm too old for climbing trees, so I'm fine with boxes. I put up about 3, in my case. It's Warry is he was a guy who invented in 1900 around. He invented this system of beekeeping to say, okay, we're going to take small boxes, which pretty much seem the same space as a bee would take in a tree hollow. We just put these boxes on top of each other, and thereby the bee colony can move freely within this hollow, which resembles a tree hollow. It's only resembling, of course, it's square boxes, so there are corners and all things, so you could still go better from there. But then we're not into honey production, food production anymore, then we're actually into bee having. So that would be having a colony in your garden, in a hollow, natural hollow preferably, and just to have it and just to have it live there. So you wouldn't want to...
It's the difference of like having a petting zoo for farm animals or farm animals for exactly. production. Sure.
So that's the point.
Where you have the dimensions here. What are we talking about in size?
It's 30 centimeters of width. It's just about 28 centimeters of height. So it is like a cube, 30 by 30 by 28. And I'm even going smaller now. So that very much depends on what you need to run your hive and what your surroundings are. But say we would have about 40 liters in a more or less square or round shape that is existing because you put a number of boxes on top of each other. So you create this cylinder that the bee can go up and down in. So that's important for the bee to have something that makes it possible for the bee to walk up and down. And this cylinder we will not interrupt by any excluding devices. So the queen can go all the way up when it's cold, and she can go all the way down when it's warm enough. So that's super important to do with that. Means a lot of work.
Mm.
Because now you cannot simply go, well, I know the top box is only honey. Because the queen couldn't have gone up there. She couldn't have laid eggs there. So I'm just going to take it off. Just take it quickly, tuck, tuck, tuck. Just take all your boxes, spin them, take the honey out, chuck them back on. Easy. This is not possible anymore. So now... you have to work your colony as an individual. Every bee colony will be different from this spot on because every bee colony behaves differently. Some build a lot of combs. Some make a lot of honey. Some just are tourists. They just hang around. They just like the space. They just do their life. They don't do anything productive for you. They do a lot of productive stuff for rearing drones, for giving genetics into the area, and simply for surviving. So you would... look at your colonies. You would have to work them all the way through from the top box to the bottom. It can be up to 5 boxes. That strong colony actually grows. So that's quite a while of work that you do. And you understand, what is this colony? How is this character? And that's when beekeeping just gets super interesting, because that's when you really learn, okay, this colony, according to the notes that I took over years, tends to do this. Now, of course, it changes with every year because it swarms and the genetics are a bit adapted to what's actually happening. But that's when you start beekeeping with the bees. Then you can go, okay, now this colony is a massive honey producer. For whatever reason, they developed into a colony that takes a lot of nectar. There is already a lot of nectar on there. So when is the time when I can now actually go, I slip in a little 10 centimeter high box, just slip it into the brood nest so they can increase the brood nest. At that moment, this colony can grow stronger. Can I slip it within the honey box? So then they make more honey, taking the honey which would fill up in the bottom box, in the brood nest, take it there. So all these things are now beekeeping possibilities when it again comes to food production, which I can do minimal invasively by doing small little adjustments or not do them. And if I don't do them, it's always the best decision. That's what I noticed. That's the thing where honey production, food production actually is interfering into colonies. Yes, we need to eat. Yes, I do food production. And whenever I don't do it, I see, yeah, well, actually, that's what the bees were set up for. So if we were super laid back and just say, look, 10 kilos of honey per colony per year is perfect. I don't need any more than this to harvest. Then we can actually really live together with bees. Let them do their thing. They'll produce enough for us to have.
Yeah. Let's quickly go over some of the other specifics of how you construct these hives, because I can only imagine the listeners are thinking, like, how can I make these myself? And
okay, easy.
When I was there for the workshop, you were very specific about the thickness and the type of the wood that you use and the little branches that are in between. Can you describe that in detail?
Yes. So what I did is I really took apart my colonies, my hives, and reconstructed them to what I think is better for them to use, better for me to work with, and better for the bees at the same time. So I pretty much rid my colonies of these so-called frames which we have. So these little frames that you can put your wax sheet in, but also that you would pull out and look at the colonies. So I just said, no, there's no frames in a tree hollow. So just give him a few sticks, crisscross sticks, which would enable the bees to build their comb around. It would stabilize the comb. It wouldn't fall off because it's getting too heavy. And at the same time, give them more insulation. So I would double up my walls from 2.2 to now close to 5 centimeters of wall thickness. You can go however thick you want. You can easily give them 10 centimeter thick walls. It's just going to be a lot of heavy lifting if you have that as a box.
Sure.
So to do that, to deal with that, I also made my boxes less high, because if they're thicker, they're heavier. If I do them less high, they'll be easier for me to carry. But still, I just stack up more boxes. So I still get to the same hollow that I need. So really what I do, give them thick insulation, build 10 centimeter high boxes, 5 centimeter thick walls with these 30 by 30, 10 centimeters high, and just chuck in a cross of sticks, or chuck in 8 sticks and a little crisscrossy for the bees to build their comb around. Now you have these stacks. Now to harvest this kind of colony, you will at some point have to cut through the comb, because now you don't have frames which separate box from box, but you have one big slab of comb going from the top of your colony to the very bottom, crossing, if you take the shallow ones, up to 10 boxes. Now you have to know your colony, because if you cut through comb and you cut through brood, you kill a lot of bees. If you know your colony, and again, we're back to the point of taking years to harvest, you know how much honey is on top. Now you can take a little 10 centimeter slab of honey off the top. You can just take a thread, like a draht, what would that be? like a metal wire? Thread, what you call it, wire. Thank you. You take a wire, you put it in between your boxes that you put on top of each other, and you just pull it through, thereby cutting the comb on the inside, and then you can lift off your top box with the honey. There won't be any bees in there, because once the honey is kept, bees pretty much leave it alone. There might be the one or other bee walking around, cresting, crossing the comb, checking if there's any mold growing or anything, just checking it. But you won't, if at all, kill bees. You just get the honey. But again, you need to know it's only honey on top of your colony. So that's why I do this after 3 years. So I get a swarm into my hives, nice thick walls, shallow boxes, just the sticks inside. Bees do whatever they want to do. They can build crisscross comb because that helps them ventilate the hot air inside. They can build comb crossing towards the entrance, so they actually block the cold winter wind from off the entrance. They can do whatever they want, whatever they think is right. I cut off my little 10 centimeter slab the first time after 3 years of waiting, because then I know there is at least 30, maybe 40 centimeters of honey on top of my hives. So cutting off 10 centimeters there won't hurt them. Also, leaving 3 boxes of honey underneath. So I'm done for the winter. I don't need to do any feeding. Once I harvest, my winter work is done. I do the same next year. So now I can always, year to year, I can cut off 10 centimeters of the hives, which is 5 kilos of honey compared to 90 kilos that you would usually harvest, or 50 to 90 kilos that you would usually harvest from a colony. So that is a lot less honey. But your colony is healthy. The design is actually quite easy. You just need a lot of time. And the honey is way better because it's really, really ripened honey. It is matured in the hive.
So let's talk about that, because I got a chance to sample some of this honey from the collaboration that you're doing with Wilmersgarten south of Berlin, which is where we met. And it is a very different product. Tell me why that is and how most honey is produced, why it's different.
Yes, very, very simple approach to look at honey, really, because usually what you would get is you would have this pre-printed wax sheet in a box with the queen excluder underneath. So all the bees can chuck in that box is nectar. This nectar, they will turn into honey. This honey is being spun out of the comb. So by spinning out of the comb, what you get is only condensed nectar. Actually, that isn't honey. We call it honey because it's the sweet part of it, but really honey consists of a lot more. So really what you get in a colony that lives wild is honey that consists of honey, of nectar, but also of fermented pollen and also of propolis. And that is simply because I don't use queen excluders. So my queen would lay eggs everywhere in the colony. Wherever there is eggs, bees need to feed these eggs for them to hatch and become healthy bees. Feeding eggs means they get nectar, but also they get pollen, and also there's propolis to keep everything clean. These combs are called brood combs, where they put the brood in. Once the brood is out, hatches out, and the nectar is coming in, and nectar is being put into a former brood cell, we would have a post-brood honey in that cell, because there was brood first, the brood hatched, then the whole place got cleaned with propolis, and then they will put the honey in. Now, this is post-brood honey. Having everything in it, having the pollen in it, because the bees have been fed with pollen, there are still cells full of pollen, which bees just chuck honey on top because they don't need it anymore. It's just there as their storage in winter. So when they feed up, they don't feed through sugar, but they also feed through pollen and propolis. So that is super healthy stuff. And this is the honey that I can harvest. And this now is the honey that I press. I don't spin it out of the comb. I press the entire comb because my bees just build new comb. So I take off a box from the top and I slid in the box at the bottom. So the volume stays the same. Bees build comb downwards, fresh comb, no loss of comb. I take the honey off the top, squish this comb, just completely crush it, let the honey drop out of it, just really dribbles, it just flows out of the crushed comb. And with the honey flows the fermented pollen and the propolis. Also, a little bit of wax. And that just gets tapped into a jar and done. That's all that happens. While by spinning, you have only the nectar part, the condensed nectar, and spinning it out means it's flying out of the comb as small little droplets at high speed, clashes into a wall, and then gets put into a bucket. Small little droplets of honey have a large surface when it comes to all the oxygen surrounding it. So what we have is oxidation. And oxidation means everything smells beautifully when you spin honey. But what you smell is volatile aroma, and that's gone. It's in the air. You want it in the honey. You want all your aroma in the honey. So not spinning it, but just crushing it and letting it drip out in thick drops of honey means a lot less surface for oxygen to oxidate your honey and to take away your volatile aroma. So you have full aroma honey, you have fermented pollen, you have propolis, and you have wax, which gives it a nice, warm, like a base sub taste to it. So that's what you get. And that is what you actually call honey. And that is why honey is so very healthy. And that's why we all know it's so very healthy, because it includes all these things. The health of just nectar condensed spun honey is way lower.
Yeah, and I can definitely attest to the vast difference in taste and experience from consuming this complete product rather than what is essentially a refined version that most of us are used to purchasing in stores. I mean, I don't even know where I would go to buy the type of honey that you're talking about now if I didn't have a source from Pilmer's Garden. Now, this is also reflective of what the bees are consuming in winter that I can only imagine has a very different effect on the health of the hive than for what you explained in the beginning is otherwise supplemented with essentially just sugar water to help them get through the winter because they have none of their own reserves, which were removed in order to get a yield from the industrial way of producing.
Exactly, because what they do have in a natural hive is not only the sugary part of the honey, but it's also the protein part of the fermented pollen, and also is the propolis part, which is antiviral and anti-fungi and antibiotics. So that is actually medicine. And they can now eat through everything they need whilst feeding them sugar to replace the honey. And the idea of feeding them sugar, I understand. It is bees need the sugar part of the honey to produce heat. So that is a very, very energy-rich food source. And they need this to produce a lot of heat to do the breeding of the colony in the summer and also to retain the heat they need over winter. So if you look at what comes into a colony in a year, which is about 350 kilos of nectar, and you get 5 kilos in the end as a storage, then you see how much of this stuff is needed to produce heat. So the beekeeper's idea to say, yeah, give them something to produce heat with, then just give them the sugar that they need. Good idea for the heating, bad idea for the feeding, because now you only have the sugar, you don't have the protein, you don't have the propolis. So it is a huge difference. And that you knowing the taste and the effect of the honey, because you've tasted it, you now know what the bees are eating.
Yeah.
And that is what's important for the bee. And that also then makes it honey important for us. So it's just being fair to both of us. The only downside of it in the end then is the amount you can harvest. And then, of course, also the price of the honey. But really, this kind of beekeeping is as close as a fair trade between bees and human as I can think of.
Sure. And there are also other reasons for doing it this way. And in a second, we can start to talk about why we would be breeding resilient hives against all of the threats out there. But, you know, there are challenges involved in this beyond just the economic difficulty and the probably steep learning curve of understanding bee behavior and the observation required to manage in this way. What are some of the other big hurdles to getting this to be more of a typical or mainstream way of managing our relationship with bees for production?
Well, the main thing is that we really need the right place to put them up. So we need a space for our bees to actually live in a healthy environment. And that is, from a bee's perspective in Germany, not only difficult, but I would say definitely impossible to find. So if you find a spot which is surrounded by 10 kilometers of healthy nature, then please let me know where that is. Because that's what bees are done for. Yeah. So there would be a high diversity of plants. There would be a high diversity of, in our region, really meadows, which would be flowering. So that's the typical kind of nectar intake that bees would have in this parts of Germany that I'm in. And that would be this famous all-time trickling in of food. There's never a lot. There's never any major honey flows. But there's always this basic trickling of nectar coming in from all our beautiful, not green at all, but colorful meadows, which our few little cows are grazing on all over the year. And then you would have a few trees would actually kick in quite a bit nectar, because there's also a little bit of forest surrounding it. And that's just what we don't have anymore. We just really have a very, very, very industrial agriculture. Our meadows are green and they're not colorful. And a green meadow is nothing I like to see. I know that is considered nature, but I need them to be colorful. So we overfeed our grass. We put too much fertilizer on it so that we can cut it up to 4 times a year so that we can feed all our cows, even if they don't have enough space to feed off. So by fertilizing our grass, we fertilize away the flowers, which need a lot less nutrition. So grass becomes greener and greener. So finding a spot where bees will find pollen and nectar in diversity throughout the year would mean healthier bees, but that we simply don't have. So we're taking away the most important part of what a bee needs, being a supply of healthy food throughout the year. And that is something we can't replace, because we cannot just add pollen nutrition to the colonies. And I know beekeepers do buy pollen, mix it into the sugar and feed it to the bees. But that's just not the same thing. We can never arrange the same diversity, and we can never give the colony also the freedom to pick what pollen do I want. Why am I going for this pollen right now? Because I want to take this pollen home and I want to feed it to a bee, thereby programming it to also become a very good pollen bee. So at a certain time of the year, a colony would feed bees in certain ways to create bees which need to do certain jobs, which then will fit what's happening out there. So either nectar collecting or pollen collecting or heating, winter bees, just breeding. So that's what we need. Very, very healthy nature. Big problem, we don't have it. So that's our main thing, really, that we're battling with. Next thing, of course, then would be to really leave them alone. And as a beekeeper, of course, the challenge of producing honey or not producing honey is a really high one. So if we want the food, we need to have the bees, we need to harvest them. But to take a lot of time working every individual beehive and then only getting a very, very small amount of honey is a major challenge for every beekeeper, because that's actually not what he's out for, because it's time and effort that makes the business run.
Indeed. Let's talk about the threats from colony collapse disorder, the different contributors to that, and how your way of managing your beehives is helping to perhaps create alternatives or combat these threats.
Yes. So colony collapse disorder is a beautiful name because it was given by beekeepers who didn't really know what was going on. So this is just something is in disorder and my colony is collapsing and I've done everything right. So what's going on? And it is a huge problem, because what we get is, as I already mentioned, our varroa mite, which is now living in colonies, just living there with the bees, growing inside the bee brood. So the bromide will crawl into the cell that the queen lay an egg in before it's being capped. So you have egg, and at some point the cell is being capped. In this capped cell, nothing can go in or out, and the bee larvae would develop in this capped cell and then hatch out of it. Now, before it's being capped, this little varroa mite, which is really, really small little thing, crawls into the cell and then is kept with the bee. So no one can now get to the varroa mite as well. It's very safe there. That's where the mite would lay eggs. That's where the mite would grow. Just one mite in, five mites out. So that's what you get throughout the year. These mites feed from the larvae while they're in this cell. Thereby, so they're like ticks. They just eat of it, of the hemolymph, of the fat part of the bee. Also, they transfer viruses because they just carry a virus. And quite a few viruses that really make the bees sick. So they are born weaker and sicker. Now, they don't live as long. In the summer, it's not so much of a problem because the summer bee typically lives up to 6 weeks and then it's just worked to death because it does all these jobs all day in and out. And that's just how long the system lasts with all the pressure. A winter bee is being bred to last 6 months because it doesn't do all the flying. It doesn't do any comb building. It only does a little bit of breeding because the queen actually doesn't lay any eggs over the winter. So there's a lot less work for this bee to do. It does, however, need to live long over the winter period and create enough heat to hold the colony warm and alive. Now, if you have a winter bee that is being born sick and weak, it simply won't live for 6 weeks, 6 months, meaning the colony dwindles away, bee by sick bee dying in the middle of winter. And then at some point, you don't have the mass to keep the hive alive, and then they simply freeze to death. So a colony disorder hive in spring, you would look at, you would have about two handfuls of bees sitting all together, the queen somewhere in the middle, the whole thing frozen to death because they were just not strong enough, not big enough to stay alive. That is the problem that we have with varroa mite, because winter bees are being bred at the point where there is the most load of mites, because they, after spring, could start developing slowly, and now they're at full power, and now they infect all the winter bees, and now they just can't make it through winter. So again, this is where beekeepers saying, look, I need the winter bees, I need the colony in spring, so I'm just going to treat against the mite, thereby fighting colony collapse disorder. And we use, and that's where we're already quite lucky, actually, doing organic beekeeping. We use organic acids to fight the mite. That is acids which also occur in the bee's body. It's like formic acid, for example. It would be oxalic acid. That would be the two typical acids that we use. They're not necessarily dangerous to the bee. They are a stress factor. They make bees again work against the acid, which is now in my hive for about 10, 14 days, all smelling everything of formic acid, which is really very aggressive. So they try to fan it out, thereby spreading it all over the hive, thereby killing the mite within the cells all over the hive. So that is all being taken care of. But of course, it's another workload to get rid of that smell. Colonies survive. There's a lot of mites dying. So pressure on the winter bees is not as bad. So there are enough bees getting us through winter. All good. As long as beekeepers do this, and as long as the varroa mite doesn't get resistant to our little treatment there, we are not breeding the super mite. Once it does get resistant, all we will be doing is breeding varroa mites instead of keeping bees healthy. So we have to get out of the cycle sooner or later. Also, because bee colonies now can't naturally die. So this is where natural selection would come in. In nature, without a beekeeper, colony disorder would have been solved. Because all the colonies that can't just find a way to cope with the mite by themselves would already be dead. Very, very rough way to look at bees is to say 95% of the colonies can't make it. They will die. That's what happens in nature. If varroa goes somewhere and it hits the bee colonies that live in nature, about 95% of bee colonies simply die within 3 to 5 years. And that means a lot less pollination, and that definitely means a lot less honey and a lot less bee colonies. But out of the 5% surviving, you would then get a buildup of colonies, which would also these only these 5% of surviving colonies would have drones and bees to mate. So that would be the genetics that then would be reoccurring. And they would again build up over the years. Now, this has happened at several points in the world. It has happened in Asia, where varroa mite started. And the Asian honeybee is resilient, and it doesn't make any, it doesn't have any problem with varroa mite. They, because they found different ways of adapting. Some bees clean, so they reopen kept cells and thereby disturb the breeding cycle of the varroa mite. Some bees chew off legs of varroa mites, so they just can't crawl anywhere. Some bees chase them out. Some bees overheat them. So there are different approaches that bees find to fight the mite. But since we fight the mite for the bees, there is no need for them to figure this out in our beekeeping part of the world. Ireland is a very, very interesting spot, because when Ireland got hit by varroa mite, there wasn't a large population of professional beekeepers, because Ireland is not the typical flowery place. It is rather rainy, so there's never a lot of nectar, a lot of honey happening there. It's mostly heather or ivy or hawthorn stuff, which is good, which is great for the bees. But no one really cared, and there wasn't really the interest of putting a lot of money into buying all these treatment stuff. So, yeah, well, we're not going to have any beekeeping then. Doesn't matter. It wasn't important anyway. In Ireland, the colonies that lived in the wild are now resistant to varroa, which is great, because they just did exactly what natural production, what natural selection does. They just died, and the surviving ones survived, and then they rebuild the bee population. So that would be an approach. Also, again, saying 30 million years of bees, they did a lot of stuff that they had to adapt to, and we weren't there to help them. But of course, that would mean giving up 95% of bee product. And we have to remember that bees are responsible for about 80% of the food we would find within our supermarkets. In any way, there's bee happening in it. So we will have to really be very, very patient and very, very well organized to let this happen. And I don't see it happening. I've tried to do this. I've tried to simply let my bees go by natural selection. Being surrounded by beekeepers that don't do it, of course, the mating progress is then again mating with drones from colonies which aren't resistant. So you never get out of the vicious cycle. I've tried this several times now. I've had several times of 95% colony losses. And it is a fight that I can't win. I would need to take my bees, and there again, whether we are, into a healthy surrounding where there are healthy bee colonies, and then it will work. But we want bees everywhere, and we need bees everywhere. So what do we do? That's the problem that I'm facing right now. So all the breeding attempts that we do to really artificially breed bees, what we try now is we try to breed bees that are very good in cleaning, because we've seen, yep, some colonies clean their hives, they open the cells, and thereby they might get rid of varroa. So we focus on this one little thing that we know might work. By breeding, we also select the kind of genetics that we want to survive. We deselect a lot of stuff that we just might not know yet. But at the end of our breeding progress, it'll be gone, because we've just bred away from it. It's not the bee deciding what is the approach to solve the problem. It's us deciding it for the bee, even though we don't really know. So it would all be about natural selection, or it is about using the knowledge that we have about a beehive to interact in a beekeeping way mechanically. And that is my approach right now, and that will need a bit more explanation in the next round.
Wow, that's a fascinating challenge to be faced with. And I definitely feel the gravity of the need for us to pull together and work on this collectively, because this is not something that any individual or even a region can take responsibility for on their own. Now,
yeah.
Where I'd like to explore now with you is a huge topic in its own right, which is the understanding of the interconnected aspects that produce healthy hives, healthy products that require deep observation, understanding of behavior, like you've given us a window into right now. And I'm brought back to a very recent conversation I had with John Kemp from AEA in the United States, who has taken on now beekeeping as a new hobby of his, and said, I'm paraphrasing here, one of the interests in doing so is that by paying attention to the life cycle, the behavior, and the environment around beehives, you are forced to gain a perspective and look broadly into the entire health of the ecology the way almost no other agricultural endeavor forces you to do. Can you expand on this and tell me about the observations and the broader perspective that you have developed to understand your own bee colonies?
Yes, very much. It is an absolutely fascinating change that happens when you interact with bees, because they really make you look at the world differently. It just simply happens. I remember this. The fun part of the story is when I started beekeeping, I started walking differently. So before that, I was just, you know, looking around, what's happening here. Now I always walk with my head up and look into the trees, what's happening there. So what's flowering? What smells am I actually catching? What information can I get out here so I know what the bees are actually encountering right now? I would call a bee colony a link between my observation, the colony, and nature surrounding it. So I could actually read a lot about nature and what's going on in around 10 kilometers around me by simply sitting in front of a beehive and watching its entrance. Because I can tell what the bees are carrying in, what kind of pollen are they bringing in. There are sheets of the colors that you can look at, and you can compare the colors of pollen coming in, and you would know what would be blossoming in the area. You could tell by what bees are throwing out of the colony, what they're doing inside, thereby knowing what is happening in the surroundings. So you really get interested in what's going on around my hive. So where are my bees going? Where are they flying? What are they actually doing? What are they finding? Why are they not doing anything today? What's happening? What's different in nature so much today that what they did yesterday is just not happening today? So is there something that has to do with the hive itself, or is it the weather itself? Because at some point you see, whoa, that's a lot of bees coming to the entrance. Oh, there's a storm coming up. Right, I might get home. So it is really, really interesting to use the knowledge that you have about a bee colony to expand it into nature surrounding you. And that will make you more aware of what is happening. And that will, of course, make you wonder, why is there a parking place being built right now? There used to be a little spot of flowering there. Now, this little spot of flowering is not going to kill my colonies, but I know there are lots of little spots of flowerings in this world which are being turned into parking places. So I'm getting interested in what impact do little things on nature actually have. At the same time, I can turn this knowledge around and say, so if I do a little patch of flowering somewhere, isn't that quite a bit? Because that's bees coming in, finding a diversity of pollen, which they might not have found before, taking it back to the hive, and thereby adding a little notch to their health. So this makes you plant for bees. And if you plant for bees, you start thinking, so what am I planting? And then you think flowers, and flowers are really pretty, and that's nice, but they're also edible flowers. So why don't I go for edible flowers? Because then I can put them onto my salad or something. And how about hedges? Now, hedges are cool because they do all this fruits and stuff, so I can actually use them too. So I'm into gardening. I'm into planting for the bees at the same time gardening. So I'm creating food, not only for my bees, but also for myself. And again, I start thinking, look, these hedges are being populated by birds. these birds are here because of the flowering that I did is attracting the feral bees, the solitary bees. They are doing a great job together with my honeybees of pollinating, which makes me pick the fruit, which falls down and feeds the hedgehog, which is safe in the in this little hedge. Also, the birds are coming here. So this is really happening. You really start to change your surroundings, and you actually start just by the means of understanding what's happening for your bees, you start interacting within nature and you become part of the whole cycle. And that's where it becomes really big, because now you're not a beekeeper anymore. Now you're just living along with nature, which you were told to improve by bees. And now you're all of a sudden notice, I'm actually feeding off the bees because I pick the fruit and I have the birds and they bring in seed and different stuff flowers and grows. And I understand that this whole thing is a great, great big year in, year out, up and down circle of feeding. Everything feeds everything. And then we are into gardening. Then, of course, we get interested in the quality of our soil that we're using. Then we're getting into regenerative farming. Then we start telling people about it. Then they start doing the same thing. So patches grow. And that is like a counter movement to taking it away, is making more and more little patches where we allow them just to find whatever they need to find.
That's not only so beautifully put, but makes me think that beekeeping is the gateway drug into regenerative living.
I think it has a lot to do
with it. Window that opens it up.
Well, because it is a living creature, and it is not too far away from being human, actually, because even though it is a superorganism, lots of things are very similar to bees. So we can very much relate to the fact that they need 35 degrees of temperature, which is their breeding temperature. So we can actually feel, oh, I'm cold today. How would my bees be? Is the insulation good enough? We are aware of the fact that we have to put a lot of effort into breeding. So yeah, that's what we do. I mean, that's what we live, we propagate, we breed, we feed, we take care. So we feel all these things that the bees, and they are a living organism. So if I'm surrounded by gardening, if I'm surrounded by nature, I see all these things, then it's easy for me to relate to another living creature. And this being such a different living creature, being a superorganism, but still living in the same place as I am, they have their home, I have my home. They go out for work, I go out for work. They produce, I produce. It's really some kind of a communication, a very independent. It's not like a dog who is just simply dependent on you, loves you, will do everything you want to do. It's just with you all the time. Great, perfect, yes. And bees are just free. They just live their own life and you have them. It's like having those birds that come back to your garden and say, oh, I know that bird. That has been here for weeks now. It's really cool. Oh, no, it's gone. It's winter. Must have gone somewhere. Oh, it's back. It's spring. Nice. So you're in interaction with everything. And that's I think bees can really, really help you get into this interaction.
And unlike almost all the other livestock I can think of that we domesticated and farm, there's no way to really limit where they go. You can't keep them confined through fencing or through other tools into a place that you actively manage, whether it's your land or something you rent or whatever. Bees cannot be confined in the same way. And so you are forced to look at how the rest of your community within at least a certain radius is being managed and care about the health and the diversity that they have access to beyond your own borders.
Exactly. So you get into conversation with your surrounding farmers, for example. You would visit them and say, hey, look, I'm having bees. I know I can't force you to do anything differently. I would love to just tell you, please do all organic. But maybe you don't. You know, you do your thing. But why don't you tell me if you go out and spray? Just give me a small call so I know that I have to close the entrance today, even though that isn't good for my bee colony, but I don't want my bees to fly into your sprayed flowers. So you know what's going on. By knowing what's going on, you also know, well, if I'm not letting my bees have that food, do I want it? Do I want that food? Or am I maybe in touch with a farmer who doesn't do that? Do I maybe move my bees to a place where that isn't happening? So this is really teaching you a lot about what's going on, and you start thinking. So that is basic knowledge on which then you can make a free decision, because bees are not domesticated. We cannot domesticate bees, and I hope we never will be able to domesticate bees, because they just go wherever they need to go.
Yeah. And that makes me think that already it's becoming increasingly popular for people to adopt an apicultural practice or some bee boxes in their even yards these days. What would you tell to people who are interested in starting something like this to look at it from the lens that you're talking about, the importance of everything that we've mentioned so far, and how they can get started? I know this is a small community of people like yourself. It's not as accessible as it should be.
Yes, so that's a little bit of the problem with it. I would say, hey, if you're interested in bees, do a beekeeping course. So because don't just get bees, because they are quite complex. You do want to know what is happening, and you do want to have the opportunity to actually work your bees. So in the beginning, you will do a lot more working your bees than is actually good for the bees. You will interfere a lot more, but you will have to, because you will have to learn, which is all fine. So beekeeping course, there we run into the first problem. Usually there are beekeeping courses which would teach you how to do beekeeping with what I call the race car system. So it would be honey focused. Most beekeeping clubs are honey focused. Try to find someone who will teach you natural beekeeping, where bees can build their own comb, where bees can swarm freely, where bees are fed on their honey, and where minimal intervention is being taught. Try to find someone like that. That could be top bar beekeeping, that could be warri beekeeping, that could be so-called Demeter bee box beekeeping. So everything that has to do with natural comb. It's fine if they use frames, it's totally okay, as long as the bees can build their own comb. And from there on, after years and years of working and practice, you can at some point make your own decisions of how you would rather have it. But do start with a beekeeping course. Do get your bees. Don't just get one colony, because it is most likely that one colony will die. Get maybe three and do your courses. Invite your friends from the courses, people that you meet at the courses, when you do your beekeeping work. So maybe you have a group of five people, which you think is really cool people in your beekeeping course. Meet up with these people. Say, okay, today I'm going to do what we learned last week. I'm going to do this frame looking at other eggs thing. I think I understood what they were talking about. Why don't we do it all together? And then tomorrow we do it all together with your bees. And then after that, we do it all together with her bees. And then we do it all together with his bees. And then I have worked maybe 20 colonies within a week. So I have a repetitive moment and I have a bigger chance to learn. So that would be the first approach that I would tell people to do. Find someone who does natural beekeeping, learn in a group, and do the work together. It's a lot of fun, and it'll give you the repetition that you need to actually understand what's going on. Yes, you need to want to do that. So, of course, there are things that are not very pleasant about beekeeping. So stinging is not fun. It's meant to hurt, and it does. So if you're not allergic, you'll never get used to it. It's just not fun, but you'll get over it. So that is something. Also, physical work in the heat. It is quite demanding to do all that in your suit in the heat. It's sweaty, it's hot, it's heavy boxes, it's a lot of lifting, it's a lot of concentration. But it's, in the end, it's absolutely worth it if you do the course and you start learning what it actually is happening. So it took, I'd say, 3 years for me to basically understand what's going on. 5 years, and that is also being very intensive, doing this every day with a lot of colonies. So I have a head start there, definitely. 5 years to feel sort of safe in my movements and not always doubting whether this is right. 10 years to be, yep, I still learn a lot from day to day, but I think I got the idea. So take your time.
Be patient. Look at it as a cultivation or a practice rather than just something that you can master.
Yeah, I think 30 million years.
That's good to keep in perspective. And speaking of perspective, what are some of the other expectations that you would hope to communicate to people interested in this as far as time investments, let's say out of a week? You know, how do you fit this into your schedule? How can this be a part of your lifestyle that is manageable for someone who's not doing this as a full-time job?
Yeah, so that's the big difference, that you're actually not doing it as a full-time job. So at my point where I'm in with my work now, I see a colony 3 times a year. That's it. There are a few more colonies and there's other stuff I look at in the time, but actual work with the bee colony is absolutely minimal because I want to disturb them as little as possible, which would not be the case. And it would not be right to be the case for someone who starts learning beekeeping. So I would suggest to go and check for, in the beginning when you learn, check your bee colony every 1 or 2 weeks. So a cycle of bees is 3 weeks. So that would be the least thing. From egg to hatching is 3 weeks. So if you want to learn what your colony is doing, checking it every month is good from the point on when you know what's happening inside. So when you learn, it'll be an hour at least, because you want to take your time per week of checking your hive together with other people who also do the same thing. So the more people you have in your neighborhood, it might either be a very, very long weekend where you actually work 3 hours per person having 3 hives, and then another 3 hours. So you're already into 6 hours. So now you've done 2 people. That's the full day. You take the Sunday, another 6 hours, you will have done 4 people. So you'll be really, really busy doing the beekeeping in the beginning. Later on, it'll be a meeting a month, a weekend a month that you do. And then at some point, you're pretty much safe with what you're doing and you just do the work. But in the beginning, yes, I would say take maybe 3 hours a week on the weekend, half your Saturday or half your Sunday to spend with your bees.
And what about financial or equipment or material considerations? How much you should consider spending to get started? And are there ways to save money on the initial investment or the equipment to begin with?
Yeah, so that's also has a lot to do with your patience and what kind of bees you have in your area. You can bait wild bee colonies. For that, you need a high density of wild bee colonies in your area. And as sorry as I am, most likely you don't have this, because there's just not enough space for bees to live in the wild, really. We take it all. We take our hollows. We cut our trees. We renovate our houses. So there's nowhere to go, really. Say you have to buy a colony. So you will need the boxes to put them in. There is a simple, for the Varie box, which I'm using, there's a simple online link that you can look it up. Just put in Varie box. Set up, hive set up. It's simple woodwork with a little bit of time. You can really easily build these colonies, these boxes. I would change the design a little bit. As I said, go for 5 centimeters of width, of strength of your wood. But do this, build your boxes yourself. You can order them online, which would mean you pay maybe 200 euros for a complete hive. So buy 3, 600, buy 3 colonies, somewhere around 150, maybe 100, maybe 200 euros. So 1,500 euros for the initial setup of 3 colonies. Then you want your suit. You want your gloves in the beginning. You need a smoker. You'll need your hive tool. So let's say 2,000. 2,000 to get it all started. Quite a bit of money. How do you want to process your honey? So if you now want to get into, okay, now I need an extractor and I need all these things to produce the honey, then it's getting really expensive, which is why beekeepers are so easily caught into, I need to make a lot of money by making a lot of honey so I can actually pay for all these expenses. Sure. But all that isn't necessary. All that is not necessary, because the reason why Emile Varie, the priest that invented this system in 1900, invented it as it is to give every family a chance to produce food in minimal work and also minimal costs. Because if you cut your comb and you press your comb, you can do that at home. Just munch it with your fingers. Just feel like a little child. Just get it all dirty and munchy and put it through a noodle sieve. Let it drop overnight and you'll have your honey. So you can really save on a lot of costs there. But hive and bees and the basic equipment that you would need, yeah, I'd guess about 2,000 euros.
Well, that's good to have in mind. And, you know, there's the option, of course, to build your own and maybe even get some hand-me-downs from beekeepers in your areas. Who knows? Yep. Get creative, careful, right?
Careful with used material. If you get hand-downs from beekeepers, make sure you flame the inside because there might be bee diseases in it. So get a torcher and flame your boxes before you put your own bees in.
Good advice. And that brings us to the community aspect. You know, maybe you'll have opportunities to get other equipment or advice. Where would you point people to start, at least in Europe or within the networks that you're aware of, to connect with people who are doing this, maybe find mentors and instructors? Where should we start?
Well, you do start with your local beekeeping club because it's always good to be connected with them. Also, law stuff that you will have to do, you will have to tell the community where your bees are. They will know how to do this. They might also have access to beekeepers who are selling swarms. So they might know a few freaks which do natural beekeeping, which they could point out. Then also, there's a lot of online platforms. There's a very good one by David Heath. He's from Wales, and he does warrior beekeeping platforms. There is very good information by John Caffis in the US and other warrior beekeepers, which really give a lot of information. There is a very good website by Tim Malfroy in Australia, who does a lot of natural beekeeping courses. And he's giving all the basic information about what do bees actually do. There's literature about natural beekeeping out there, which you could read. But most thing, really get together with your community and also people who don't do natural beekeeping. They do have quite a bit of bee knowledge. They might try to intimidate you a little bit by saying, yeah, but this is not how you do it. You actually have to do it like this. Just stay strong, take their knowledge and apply it to what you think is happening with your bee colonies. So yeah, be in touch with people in groups, with the forums and that kind of stuff.
And that's fantastic advice. And man, I'm almost pained to keep it to the hour and 40 minutes that we were here now. Like, I have so many more questions. This is something I'm really interested in. It might be a little while before I have the capacity and the time to really get into it, but I can absolutely see it in my future. In fact, I've already been scoping out sites on my own land that might be appropriate to put my hives that are in the forest. So we will definitely keep in touch. I want to thank you as well for the little workshop that we did when we met in person. This really opened my eyes to the possibility and the new perspectives that I really hadn't heard around this culture of beekeeping and the alternatives that you presented. It was really impactful for me, and I'm so glad that we get to share this on this podcast. I hope there will be some follow-ups, and I would love to hear more in the future about how your different experiments and your initiatives and your colonies are doing moving forward as well.
Well, we definitely might have another chat in, let's say, a few years, maybe 3 to 5 years, because what I need to try now is to not rely on natural selection, but to really see in how far beekeeping jobs with the colonies, how I can actually do things along the development of a bee colony, work with the bees to get rid of the varroa mite. So there's quite a bit of research to be done.
Very important. I look forward to hearing more about that. I'll put that for 3 years on my calendar for right now.
Yeah, let's do that.
All right.
Let's see how far I got.
Uli, it was an absolute pleasure getting to talk to you today. Let's be in touch, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Great. Big pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thanks once again to Uli. You can find his contact and all of the links that he shared with me to get an even deeper look into the world of beekeeping and many of the ways to start building community around it in the show notes on this episode on the website at regenerativeskills.com. Now, before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account at regen_skills is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.